individual DCFS defendants made these reports based on the credible evidence burden of proof, under which even a scintilla of evidence of a neglect was enough to find plaintiffs guilty. Individual DCFS defendants then placed the defamatory indicator report.
Is there any case that says a scintilla?
A case?
You use the term scintilla as the equivalent of the standard. Is there any case that supports that?
I don't know of any case that uses those
scintilla
words.
Scintilla has a very definite meaning in the law, and is that really an accurate reflection of that?
Yes, I think it is. The allegations of the complaint were precisely that the credible evidence burden of proof was a very low burden of proof, much lower than probable cause, under which any evidence of neglect, unless it was facially implausible or inherently incredible, was enough to find a person guilty without regard or without weighing any exculpatory evidence.
Now, are you saying that that standard is just unconstitutional on its face, or are you saying it's unconstitutional as it has been applied here in Illinois?
As it's been applied here in Illinois, the use of the credible...
To these particular defendants?
Yes. The use of the credible evidence standard as an investigative tool without further and even make findings and place them in the register alone wouldn't necessarily implicate any deprivation of due process rights. What makes it unconstitutional, as explored fully in Judge Palmer's decision in Dupuy, is when the resulting indicated report, which is defamatory, saying a person is a child abuser or neglector, is then disseminated and used to affect deprivations of constitutional rights. Here, the deprivation of people's protected interests.
And when does that happen? How much is any dissemination permissible? Dissemination permissible? When does dissemination become unconstitutional?
There's widespread dissemination. Not any dissemination is permissible, but it's widely disseminated to law enforcement authorities, to other public officials, and most relevantly here, to all child care employers. If you're employed currently, your employer is immediately notified of that indicated report.
Is that unconstitutional?
The
present employer is told.
If it results in the deprivation of a protected property, of a protected liberty interest, as here, it becomes unconstitutional, yes.
Well, what would be the, what protected property interest is harmed at that point?
It's not a protected property interest. I misspoke, Judge. The interest at stake here is the protected liberty interest in pursuing one's career in employment opportunities.
Is that damaged when the immediate employer is told?
When there's a plus that happens, which in this case is the discharge, there's many cases in the circuit saying that the discharge, the defamatory conduct, which would be the dissemination of the indicated report, plus a discharge would be enough to make a stigma plus tort.
Happy point.
I'll be addressing only two issues in the first instance, unless the court has questions on others. The first issue is whether the DCFS defendants are entitled to qualified immunity as to plaintiff's credible evidence claim on the ground that plaintiff's rights were not clearly established at the time the violations occurred. It's noteworthy that in the district court, the DCFS defendants did not argue that any of them were entitled to qualified immunity as to plaintiff's notice and timely hearing claims, nor under the first part of the familiar qualified immunity test did they argue in the district court that plaintiff's credible evidence claim was not one upon which relief could be granted. Judge Palmar concluded that the law as to plaintiff's credible evidence claim was not clearly established for qualified immunity purposes. A first mistaken premise of that ruling was that the Second Circuit's decision in Belmonte and the New York Court of Appeals decision in Lee T.T., which are two of the three decisions on which plaintiffs relied to show that the law was clearly established, showed no such thing because those two decisions were not binding precedent on any of the DCFS defendants. But the notion that just because a decision is not a binding precedent, it cannot clearly establish the law for qualified immunity purposes is squarely contrary.
Those cases aren't exactly on all fours, are they?
Belmonte and Lee T.T. are on all fours.
In your view?
in Murray, the New York scheme, which was at issue in both those cases, had the credible evidence standard of proof, and it was applied in a materially identical way.
Do they still apply that standard?
New York, no.
No, here.
They apply the standard, but they have a prior hearing and notice, which was what was lacking there. Under a preponderance standard. They use it for investigative purposes, as I indicated in response to Judge Ripple's question before. So it's not used in a, not used anymore as it was used then. It's used for a much more limited purpose. Burgess is the case that says that just because the case is not binding precedent, that's not.
Now, in the New York case, I believe it's the Second Circuit case, am I correct?
Belmont.
It says that it was established there that 75% of these things turned out to be false, am I correct?
That's correct.
And now, at this stage, when these people acted, when these officers here in Illinois acted, did they have any idea that that was the batting average in Illinois, that the procedure set up in Illinois was going to accomplish the same sort of batting average?
Well, I can't speak to their subjective state of mind. I can say that in Belmont, that in Dupuy, we proved and Judge Pallmeyer found that, in fact, there was an identical error rate going. And that aside, what cases like Santowski teach is that you can make that risk of error analysis, which is the salient analysis here, even if you don't have precise statistics, just by ascertaining that the lower the standard, obviously, the higher the risk of error. Thus, beyond a reasonable burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof, you're not going to get very many positives.
Suppose the record in this case showed that the post-deprivation process was in fact provided within the 30 days, okay?
Yes.
Religiously, no question about it. Would that change the situation in terms of the constitutionality of the actions of these defendants?
I would say it would. Well, first there would still be the notice problem, and I would say that it would depend if it were.
Okay, let's just put that aside for a moment. I understand your point on the notice problem, but in terms of the due process problem, just taking care of this stigma situation, would that be enough?
I'd like to think about that a little more, and maybe I'll change around. But I would say that. No, it wouldn't take care of the problem, because the deprivation would take effect and the deprivation would be here the loss of career opportunity under a standard of proof which would give rise to too high a risk.
Does the register show whether or not there has been a hearing, at what stage of the proceedings things are at?
The only thing that people are informed about, I don't think the register itself does show that, no. The only thing that an employer is informed about is that the person is convicted or has been found to be guilty of child abuse and neglect.
So in other words, it doesn't show that a hearing is pending?
No.
Which might make a huge difference.
Yes, it could certainly make a huge difference.
Somebody's been accused, nothing's been proven yet, there's a hearing pending.
Right.
No reason why that couldn't have been put in the register, is there?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, and in response to your previous question about the post-deprivation process, I'm not suggesting that that system wouldn't be infinitely better than the one that occurred as we pled and is admitted here. The hearings here from Mr. Canola and Ms. Dwell took well over a year before there was a decision, and they were out of work.
The reason why I'm dwelling on this is, as you know, we do use a two-step analysis in qualified immunity cases. The first step is we're supposed to find, the Supreme Court tells us, whether there's been any constitutional violation here or not. And I think we really need to see if we can't get to the bottom of that, as well as the question of whether or not these people should have known of it.
Yes, well, I'd refer the court to Belmonte and Lee T.T. and the Illinois Appellate Court decision in Cavaretta, as well as Judge Palmer's lengthy decision in Dupuy, which of course doesn't go to the second part of the test, but certainly goes to the first part. And just to finish up on this first part of the qualified immunity test here, I think that under Santowski and under Belmonte and under TT, we certainly were entitled, if risk of error becomes crucial, we certainly were entitled to be able to prove that there was a high risk of error at the time, and that a reasonable people standing in defendant's position would have known that there was a high risk of error. So I certainly think that we state a claim. Whether we might eventually prove it would be a different question.
You've got a few more points to make, don't you?
I do, but I see my light.
Okay, I'm going to give you the extra 5 minutes, and I'm going to give you folks an extra 5 minutes as well. This is, I think we all need the extra time to get through this and make this fair. So you've got five more. You folks figure out how you want to use five more, too.
Five more in addition to the five rebuttal, or five more?
Five more in addition to the 15 you had. So,
okay. Having rejected Belmonte and Lee TT as cases clearly establishing the law because they were not binding precedent, Judge Palmer then rejected the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in Cavaretta as clearly establishing the law, even though it was binding precedent. Now, the DCFS defendants insist that Cavaretta only invalidated the use of the credible evidence standard at, quote, the administrative appeal hearing for expungement, as distinguished from its use as the basis for making an indicated report in the first instance, and so including it in the State Register for Dissemination. But Judge Palmeyer herself rejected this reading of the case, which in any event is contradicted by both the text of the decision and by the Cavaretta Court's heavy reliance on Belmonte. And I just refer the Court to the Cavaretta Court's discussion, which is at page 28 and 29 at 277 Illinois App 3rd. Just as clear as day what the Court held there. Judge Palmeyer also said that Cavaretta did not clearly establish the law because it is but a, quote, single decision from a state appellate court. We respectfully submit that ruling is wrong in three ways. First, this Court's decision in Burgess dispels the notion that a state appellate court decision is not entitled to fully as much weight as a federal court appellate decision for purposes of showing whether the law was clearly established. Indeed, the Supreme Court's decision in Wilson teaches that in determining whether a right is clearly established, Cavaretta alone, without regard to any of the other cases, is sufficient support for the conclusion that the law here was clearly established as to plaintiff's credible evidence claim, as it is a case of controlling authority in the jurisdiction.
That court had to deal with the fact that, as I understand it, at that time Illinois was using a lower standard at the post-deprivation hearing as well, was it not?
That is correct.
So that things changed in Illinois after that. Why weren't these officials able to look at that case and say, well, yeah, a case came down and Illinois did something about it, and this new procedure probably is all right? I mean, our lawyers looked at it and came up with a different way of doing things. We're using the different way of doing things.
Because I don't think that's at all a reasonable reading of Cavaretta. Judge Palmeyer himself rejected that reading of Cavaretta. One looks at the decision, the salient words, if you look at the court's language, the court declares it violative of due process and says that the use of the credible evidence standard to affect indicated reports inclusion in the state register is unconstitutional. The words inclusion in the state register are the operative words in that opinion, because inclusion in the register occurs as soon as the investigator makes his factual finding and transmits the report to the state register, which is months, or in the case of Ms. Doyle and Mr. Knowles, can be years before any hearing is concerned. So while the court there's no reference in the court's discussion of expungement, of the unconstitutionality of the credible evidence standard, there's no reference to expungement appeal hearings. It just isn't there. They're talking about its inclusion in the register in the first instance. I want to turn briefly to the state agencies. The issue I want to address is the issue is whether under the Stigma Plus test, plaintiffs state claims for relief against the agencies for deprivation of their constitutionally protected interest in employment opportunities. Judge Palmeyer held that plaintiffs did not state claims relying principally on this court's decision in Pfister. But in our opening brief, we explained that Pfister held only the obvious, that in a stigma plus case, to survive a motion to dismiss, the plaintiffs must allege that defendants acting under color of state law collectively were responsible for both the stigma and the plus. Plaintiffs did that here. So Pfister does the agencies no good, and they're forced to press on with their extravagant fragmentation defense, which is essentially that as applied to a stigma plus case, to survive a motion to dismiss, a plaintiff must allege as to each individual defendant that that individual defendant personally engaged in conduct giving rise to both the entire stigma and the entire plus. That is, that each individual defendant caused the entire constitutional deprivation. I think I can offer a short example which exposes the poverty of that sort of reasoning and just ask the court to vary the facts in the Doyle complaint only slightly by assuming that Ms. Doyle, instead of being employed and fired by Camelot based on the DCFS indicated report against her, was employed by DCFS itself in its field division, and that Supervisor X, head of the field division, personally fired her based on the same indicated report. On this assumption, Ms. Doyle's suit here would have been brought not against Camelot, but against Supervisor X individually, as well, of course, as against the other DCFS defendants who made the credible evidence report and disseminated it. Now, assuming that the defendant child welfare agencies here are deemed to be state actors, the agency's position in these cases is therefore just like that of Supervisor X in my example. But surely Supervisor X would not be let off the Section 1983 liability hook just because he only fired Ms. Doyle, contributing only the plus to the stigma plus tort. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Lehrer.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Light.
May it please the Court, Eric White for the State Appellees. After a lengthy investigation by trained investigators, DCFS determined that these plaintiffs, that there was credible evidence that these plaintiffs had committed child abuse and neglect. These plaintiffs worked with private child welfare agencies, and their positions allowed them to come into contact with children. DCFS therefore quickly notified their employers that there was credible evidence that these plaintiffs had committed child abuse or neglect. Plaintiffs claimed that the state defendants thereby deprived them of due process because they didn't first provide them a pre-deprivation hearing. State defendants are entitled to qualified immunity on this claim because on both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis. The first prong, as the court realizes, is whether or not the state defendant's conduct was unconstitutional. And of course, the Supreme Court has said that this court must address that regardless of whether or not it was addressed in the district court. As to that prong, the state defendants did not violate the plaintiff's due process rights for the simple reason that they were not required to provide a pre-deprivation hearing in the first place. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said that due process is a flexible concept which requires those procedural protections which the situation demands. Ordinarily, it is true that before a state may deprive an individual of a liberty interest in employment, the state must provide an informal hearing in accordance with Loudermill. However, the Supreme Court has determined that there are certain situations when a post-deprivation hearing will adequately satisfy due process, and there are three requirements for that to be the case. First, there must be an important governmental interest at stake. Second, there must be a substantial assurance that the state's action is not baseless or unwarranted. And third, there must be a reason, a need for prompt action. These three requirements are met in this case. First, there's clearly an important governmental interest in notifying the private welfare agencies of the credible evidence finding. This is the state's interest in protecting children from abuse and neglect is undisputed. And indeed, this interest is at least as compelling as the interest that the Supreme Court has found will justify dispensing with a pre-deprivation hearing in various other cases. For example, in the Gilbert case, the interest at stake was the government's interest in maintaining the integrity of a university police force when one of the officers was found to have possessed marijuana. in Barry, the interest at stake was the integrity of the sport of horse racing. I would submit to the court that the state of Illinois' interest in protecting children from abuse and neglect is at least as important as those interests at stake in Gilbert and Barry. Second, in addition to a governmental interest, there's a substantial assurance that the deprivation in this case was not baseless or unwarranted.
Well, there, you know, Mr. Light, I think part of your problem is that the batting average of this procedure apparently isn't terribly good.
Your Honor, the allegation that arises in their reply brief is that 75% of those indicated reports which are appealed are reversed. This tells us nothing about the entire pool of indicated reports. It doesn't tell us that 75% of all indicated reports are reversed, only 75% of those which are ever appealed, which is a smaller number. And of course, you would expect
that 75% of the cases appealed from this court to the Supreme Court are when they accepted are reversed.
And if that were true, that would not show that the district court is making numerous errors, because it doesn't include all the cases that the district court is deciding. And similarly, just because, for the sake of argument, 75% of the appeals are successful, that doesn't mean that 75% of all indicated findings are erroneous. We're talking about different pools of numbers there.
Why can't the state of Illinois, in the register, simply indicate whether an appeal is pending, whether something is final or it's not final? Somebody looking at the register would know, all right, an allegation's been made, there's been a preliminary assessment of it, people are looking into it, that's the situation. As I understand it, there's no differentiation made between somebody who is, for which there's simply been some credible evidence of this, and somebody who's gone through the full 9 yards of a hearing and been found, in fact, to have committed the situation of which they're accused.
Well, an indicated finding by definition means there's credible evidence that the individual has committed child abuse and neglect, and so when the state notifies the employer of an indicated finding, by definition that's what it means, and the individual does have the opportunity to file an appeal and challenge that, and there's nothing that prevents them from informing anyone who is interested that they are filing.
If there's no appeal from that finding, or no complaint from the person alleged to be the abuser, that ends it, doesn't it?
They have to take a step and ask for an appeal.
So as a practical matter, until that happens, there is no appeal pending. So the action, so far as it is gone, is final.
That's true. The initial notice would not say that there's an appeal pending, because
there is.
They wouldn't have had the opportunity.
So they have 30 days to do that. Is that right?
I believe it's 60 days.
60 days?
I think so, yeah.
What about the time? It seems that you're talking about with post-death deprivation. Obviously, it's an important state interest, and even if it's not baseless. But what about the time between the deprivation and the hearing? Does that come into the constitutionality issue?
There is a claim that there is an unduly long time between the time for the request for an appeal and the time there's a final decision. In this case, in both of these cases, the time between a request and an ultimate decision by the director was slightly less than a year, which our position is that the persons responsible for scheduling these hearings were engaged in essentially quasi-judicial activities of scheduling a hearing on the merits, and so they are entitled to absolute immunity on that claim.
Well, we're on the basic subject of immunities, and I noticed that your brief doesn't deal with the Coeur d'Alene problem argument raised by the judge in the Southern District of Illinois. Is the state simply not interested in that, in presenting that argument to us?
My analysis of the case was that it was more of a problem of personal responsibility, that the complaint alleged DCFS does this, DCFS does that, DCFS routinely does this or routinely fails to do that, and it was promptly analyzed as a, in many cases, as a lack of personal responsibility, that these individual defendants cannot be said to have committed or be responsible for all the alleged violations which the plaintiffs allege. So I thought that was the preferable way of analyzing it.
Thank you.
As just briefly on the qualified immunity, whether or not it was clearly established, the Cavaretta decision, the plaintiffs misread that case. If you look at the case, the way the court frames the issue, when it starts talking about the credible evidence standard, it says, the issue is the validity of the credible evidence standard of review. Standard of review that is used by the ALJ to review the indicated findings. And we know this is what the ALJ, what the court in Cavaretta was talking about, because it cited the provision in the Illinois Administrative Code which sets forth that the ALJ shall review an indicated finding by the for credible evidence, to see if there's credible evidence. Since that time, that regulation has been changed, and now the ALJ reviews it on the preponderance of the evidence.
So the state is not arguing that it has no obligation to look at federal constitutional holdings from Illinois courts?
The state is not arguing that it has no obligation. We're simply saying that that case is distinguishable.
Okay. Are you arguing, as has been argued in some quarters, that you are really don't need to look at that case, or these officials did not, because it was simply the holding of one appellate district?
No, it is part of the fabric that the officials must look at.
Thank you, Mr. Wright.
We simply ask that the court affirm the judgments below. Thanks.
And we'll hear now from Ms. Bremer.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I will only be addressing the issue of whether there was state action by the private defendants here. My colleague will address the issue of whether there was constitutional deprivation. In these cases, the plaintiffs have failed to allege sufficient facts to establish that the private defendants were in fact acting under color of state law when they terminated the employment of the plaintiffs based on an indicated report of child abuse and neglect. Judge Herndon, in his decision, thoroughly analyzed the written state regulations, and he found that there wasn't even a suggestion, much less coercion, significant encouragement, or a requirement that these private defendants were required to terminate the employment of the plaintiffs under these circumstances. In addition to the written state regulations, the plaintiffs have also alleged that there were other policies that required their termination. They set forth these policies with specificity in their complaint, but when you cut through all the conclusory language of these allegations, what these plaintiffs are alleging is that there was a state regulation that mandated that these private agencies be prohibited from employing individuals who had been indicated as guilty of child abuse and neglect from holding positions where they would have contact with children. The plaintiffs further alleged that in order to comply with this regulation, that these private defendants, in fact, enacted their own personnel policies, which in some instances either resulted or required the termination of the employment of these individuals who were indicated as guilty of child abuse and neglect. These allegations fall far short of what is required to show that there was coercion, encouragement, or a requirement such that the decisions of these private entities could be deemed the decision of the state. Even if the state did have policies that required the termination of these plaintiffs by these defendants, to suggest or to accept that a private citizen or a private entity simply in complying with state law and obeying the law should be subject to the risks of constitutional liability would be bad public policy, especially in these circumstances where the safety and the protection of minor children is at issue. Additionally, these plaintiffs have failed to allege any facts which support their theory that the services provided by these private defendants were in fact exclusive and traditional state functions. What they argue is that it is the status of these children involved as state wards that's dispositive on this issue. So what they're saying is that because these children were state wards, the state provided funding and contracted with these agencies to provide housing, education, and mental health services for these children. That argument has been rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in Rendell Baker v. Cone, a case that's factually similar to this case. In that case, the Supreme Court said that the fact that the state was paying that school and contracting with that school to provide the education of these children did not change the relationship between the school and its teachers and its counselors. And that's what plaintiff is asking this court to do. And this court should reject that argument as the Supreme Court did in Rendell Baker v. Cone. Judge Herndon carefully analyzed the applicable regulations and policies. He applied the correct legal standard and he reached the correct conclusion that these private defendants were not acting under color of state law, and his decision should be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Reimer.
Thank you.
Mr. Jepson.
May it please the court. I represent Camelot Care Centers in the Doyle case. And Judge Pallmeyer did not even reach the question of whether Camelot was a state actor, because Judge Pallmeyer found that there was no constitutional deprivation. And we ask that this court affirm Judge Pallmeyer's finding, although we do concur in Ms. Bremer's presentation and, of course, in the brief that we are not a state actor. The facts alleged in the complaint, the facts that obviously this court must take as undisputed, show that Doyle and Connell both at-will employees. As such, there's no question of any property interest here. The issue is whether there's been a deprivation of a liberty interest, which would require that not only that there was a firing, but there was such an action taken here, a defamation, effect of the reputation, that in essence she would be barred and he would be barred from employment in their field by the actions taken here. What Judge Pallmeyer found is that Camelot Care Centers did nothing that caused the stigma, did nothing that barred the plaintiff from employment in the field. What she found was Camelot terminated an at-will employee pursuant to Camelot's internal policies. She found that what plaintiffs complained of were the procedures set up by the state and an investigation done by the state under those procedures and a result that the state came to and then registered with the state registry. And indeed, the allegations of the complaint show that both Connell and Doyle, in Doyle's case within a couple of months, became employed in their field. They did not lose their licenses. They did not have any other ill effects of Camelot's action. And Camelot's action was proper and lawful in that these employees were at-will employees. Now, the Stigma Plus test, we differ with the plaintiffs and how that should be applied here. We don't think it applies at all. In our view, the cases that deal with the Stigma Plus test apply it when the defamation that is alleged alone does not cause a constitutional deprivation. Here in this case, everything that is alleged with respect to what the state defendants did is not only the defamation, we didn't defame, and there's no allegation here that we did. It was done by the state defendants. We had no role in it. We did not take any role in the stigma and the alleged deprivation of the liberty interest at play here. And as far as the fragmentation argument goes, we also believe that that is a red herring in this case, because for the same facts. And that is, everything that's being complained of here that is allegedly unconstitutional or a constitutional deprivation of a liberty interest was done by the state defendants, and Camelot had no role in that. If there are no further questions, I would just point the court to our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Jeff.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes, sir.
In the 2 minutes I have, I want to touch upon several points briefly. First, to pick up on the hypothetical that Judge Ripple, you asked me in the first instance, I would remind the court that's very much a hypothetical. The hearings here were held more than a year after the constitutional deprivation took place. In response to your question about whether the post-deprivation process would have been adequate, I'll stand on my answer, but just qualifying it by saying it, that it would change the analysis only if there were no pre-deprivation hearing was required and if the 30 days were deemed to be a sufficiently prompt hearing. As to the Cavaretta case, let me just read a sentence out of the Cavaretta case as to what that court held. The credible evidence standard is deficient because it does not require the fact finder to weigh conflicting evidence. The fact finder, as the DuPuy decision makes clear among many other cases, is the investigator who's making the indicated report in the first instance. He's not required to weigh conflicting evidence, and it's on that ground, what the fact finder is doing in the first instance, that the court says is constitutionally deficient. That should scotch the notion that their credible evidence standard is restricted to expungement hearings. As to the fragmentation defense,
do the regulations require that anyone review that investigator's report?
There's a supervisory review of them, but we joined, in fact, all the supervisors in these cases. As to the fragmentation defense, the agencies reduced themselves to the proposition that we only fired them, which is simply a statement that they only contributed the plus. The stigma plus tort is 1,000 cases saying that both are necessary, but when both are present, the constitutional deprivation is affected. They therefore participated in the constitutional deprivation, they caused the constitutional deprivation, and they should be held liable. As to the state action question, Judge Hearn, the ruling is just incorrect. The narrowest statement of the significant involvement branch of that theory, the narrowest statement is that if a state strongly encourages or effectively directs certain actions, it becomes action by the nominally private entity becomes state action. That's a impermissibly narrow statement of the significant involvement test. But we need even that. We specifically allege that DCFS strongly encouraged and effectively directed the agency is here to fire the plaintiff. We should at least afford the opportunity to prove that. There's already record evidence basically showing that, but we certainly should have been entitled the opportunity to prove that. As to the public function theory, which is a second branch of our theory, the challenged actions here, their firing was done in furtherance of the delegated state function. The traditional state function of care, indeed the exclusive state function of caring for state wards. The allegations of the complaint are that the agencies fired Dole and Knoll based on the DCFS indicator reports against them for having neglected children. The children the plaintiffs were found guilty of neglecting were state wards. The state had delegated to the agencies the function of caring for state wards. Therefore, the agency fired Doyle and Knoll in the exercise of the delegated responsibility to care for the state ward.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Thank you, and we ask the decision be reversed.
The court thanks all counsel for their very fine presentations today, and the case will be taken under advisement. The third case of the morning is number 013384, the United States against William.